From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents the second segment in a series of conversations about the state of the English language, its history and evolution since the time of Shakespeare. The speakers are Connie Ebley, Margretta De Grazia, Michael Montgomery, and Ronald Butters. Connie Ebley teaches English and linguistics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where she directs the graduate program in the Department of English. Margretta De Grazia is a scholar at the National Humanities Center on leave from Georgetown University. At the center, she's writing a book about Shakespeare and language. Michael Montgomery directs the graduate program in linguistics at the University of South Carolina. He's an editor for the American Dialect Society. Ronald Butters teaches English and composition at Duke University, where he serves as editor of American Speech, a journal of linguistics. Here is Connie Ebley.
Let me refer back to the speakers of English during Shakespeare's time, the sorts of people who would have been in the audience. It strikes me that the tolerance of people at that time for variation in language was very great. Mm-hmm. For one thing, the characters were all portrayed by male actors, and so they were willing to have a young male play Juliet. Mm-hmm. They were also willing to listen to language that was full of puns and apparently must have enjoyed that language very much. Mm-hmm. They were also attuned to different sorts of syntactic structures that might accomplish the same meaning. For example, Shakespeare could either say, why walk you so slowly, or why did you walk so slowly? Mm-hmm. Either way of forming a question. Shakespeare could have what are called double superlatives. That was the most unkindest cut of all. These were alternate structures that were available in the language, and Shakespeare used them all. And the audience.
So it was a form of dramatic delight, a deviation from what the audience would recognize as, quote, standard, unquote.
No, the audience had no concept of, my feeling is that the audience had no concept of standard.
Mm-hmm. I see.
That's mm-hmm. my feeling. I'm not certain. I don't even know how that could be proven. Mm-hmm. And that not having a concept of standard, they simply took what was presented to them and they delighted in it, if it in fact delighted them, mm-hmm. artistically, mm-hmm. aesthetically.
Mm-hmm. Margretta?
I'll comment on one of the features that Connie mentioned in describing how many possibilities existed within the language, within the form of dramatic representation itself that Shakespeare could draw on and expect his audience to respond to. And what I'd like to make a comment about is just that very small unit of the word that Shakespeare could use, a single word, that was a homonym for other words, and expect his audience to pick up on 2, 3, 4 senses of a single word. And I think that's one way in which language worked in the 16th century, that it has ceased to work. Mm-hmm. If you read Shakespeare's plays, and these were plays to, of course, be performed, these were sounds that were heard, and apparently were heard as designating not just one reference, but several, and several at once. And to imagine an audience that was capable of responding to a single word, working on so many levels, I think demands a lot of imagination on our part, because mm-hmm. I think for us, puns are peculiar features of language. They occur now and then, and they draw attention to themselves, and you laugh at them, or are amused by them, admire them, or deplore them for that reason. But they're so ubiquitous in Shakespeare. They're such a central feature, and they're not always there as a source of humor by any means. They're not always there to disrupt. Often, several meanings, what we regard as different meanings, are converging on that one sound. And I think it's an interesting phenomenon because it goes back to, again, what Connie was emphasizing, the malleability of the language. I think a word, that more demands are put on a word, on a sound, to mean one single thing once dictionaries come into being. because before that, take a common Elizabethan homonym, the one on bear, the bear that is an animal, bear to give birth to, bear to suffer, and their various variations that we would no longer regard as being homonymic in the period born, meaning a boundary in a barn, a child. All of those words sounded approximately the same, could be used, could be pronounced once and evoke several of those meanings. To Elizabethans, once the dictionary takes over and separates all those designations, gives them separate entries into the dictionary, you're much less inclined to hear them all when you hear the sound pronounced. Mm-hmm. And I find that a very, very representative of how the entire language is working, that it does have a vitality, a suppleness, that is denied it subsequently when regulations become more standardized and when writers and the people for whom they are writing are more conscious of a standard,
Is this why Elizabethan English is viewed as the pinnacle of English? I'm not sure I have ever heard an articulation of that point of view with reference to the specific characteristics of Elizabethan English, why it is supposed to be the heyday of the English language.
Well, you see, if you say the English language, that's not quite correct, because there's literature, that's what there is, and whether mm-hmm. literature is language is another question. If mm-hmm. you move into the 17th century and into the 18th century, you'll find writers who are very critical of language in the Renaissance, but that's because standards mm-hmm. have changed and expectations have changed. Mm-hmm. For example, in the 17th century, what you'll find is that everyone is very interested in having language represent the world in some sort of scientific and objective way. That's a new criterion that wasn't present in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. And you want to expel many of the features that were once at the heart of language in the 16th century, including precisely the kind of ambiguity that I'm talking about that's present in a homonym. It mm-hmm. isn't efficient if you want to describe the world objectively, accurately, to have a word that goes in several different directions. Mm-hmm. And all of these various types of phenomena seem related. It's not just a coincidence that at the same time that you become interested in having a language that's true to the world, that you also have a movement that culminates in the development of a dictionary. And it seems that both of those tendencies run very much counter to the kind of literature that flourished in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. So I would be very hesitant about saying that there was a heyday of language in the English Renaissance, because it depends on what you mean by language, what criteria you're applauding when you make that kind of a comment. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Connie?
I think that the reason we look back on that day as the heyday is that that happens to be the variety of language of Shakespeare and of the mm-hmm. King James Version of the Bible.
That's it.
It's for cultural reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare is our greatest author in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people think. That's what everyone thinks. And the King James Version of the Bible is the way that we learn Scripture. And I think that that's why we think that language is the greatest stage of the language.
Mm-hmm.
Margretta, getting back again to the audience of Shakespeare, do you have any notion about the percentage of people who would have been literate at the time, who would be in the audience? And if that would have some bearing on their ability to understand those puns?
I don't think that would. Mm-hmm. I think that it was so much a basic feature of language that words could have multiple designations that I don't think it would have demanded any kind of literacy. And although I don't think, say, the scenes in Shakespeare's plays that depict characters from lower life are necessarily accurate reflections of what there were in England, they might be, and certainly the puns as heavily infest their language, sometimes more heavily, at least puns of a humorous nature are more present in those scenes. In any case, the plays on language, the multiple designations are as present there as they are in the scenes representing individuals from higher ranks.
Actually, I was thinking the other way around. I was thinking that people who did not read and write would be more attuned.
Okay.
Yeah. The way that children love to play with the language of 3-4 years old and make up sounds and giggle when they make up new sounds, and they're not yet fixed with the notion of the way something looks
right.
and the way it should right. be pronounced.
But that what's so interesting about that, Connie, is that because spelling isn't standardized, spelling isn't going to fix a word in a particular form either. Mm-hmm. So that even if you are reading, words are appearing in several different forms, even on the same page when written by the same author. So there's a way in which language isn't insisting that the word be fixed, even in printed form. And I'm not so sure about this, but my guess would be that even those who did a great deal of reading in the period, who weren't merely dependent on language as spoken, as sounded, that even as they read, that what was printed on the page in some sense was resounding in their minds, even though they weren't voicing the words as they read them on the page. But what I do think is true of those who were literate and of those who were not, language was sound. Even when it was printed on the page, it was sound.
Language, spelling doesn't really become standardized until relatively late in the 18th
right.
century, so we're really dealing with a sort of semi-literate audience, which is kind of ironic that in this great outflowing of language, the audience is, it's not only a matter of spelling, but there's just not that much for them to read, really, in comparison to what increasingly is accumulated.
Right. No, that's true. I think that's one thing that, that people aren't sufficiently aware of is how very different a Shakespearean text looks in the original than it does in the modern edition.
Well, Margretta, you've been describing a very fluid situation, an enormous amount of change, words coming and going and shifting. Is the hue, is the cry today, the criticism about language weakening, does that stem from the fact that we have so many more people who are aware of language as language, who are literate and who read and who write? Is it simple nostalgia that the critics are indulging in when they say, "Oh, the language is just going to pot"?
I think it's fear. That's what it looks like to me, of being out of control. And it's interesting to read. Well, so some of the things that Samuel Johnson writes before putting together his extraordinary dictionary, there is such a sense that the language is in a state of change and that common usage is taking over, that all kinds of values are being undermined that need to be preserved.
Is this a political impulse?
No,
is it a personal impulse? How would you describe it?
No, it's a social phenomenon. More and more people are having to use the English language for public purposes. They're exposing the language they use. And if we judge that language on the basis of literary standards, which is what we've done in previous centuries, it's obviously going to come up short. I think it's extremely ironic that as many people who talk about the heyday of English being in one previous century or another, whether 16th century, 18th century, I've yet to hear someone who actually wants to go back to those centuries or who actually wants to use, you know, the language of Shakespeare. And I think that's extremely ironic. I think it tells us a couple of things. One of the things it tells us is that this may be only part of the story, this attitude about language once being more capable, more expressive. If you talk to people about their attitudes toward language, you'll find that quite a number of people have a contradictory attitude about language. That is, they may think that Shakespeare was more expressive, but they
more expressive than they are.
more expressive than 20th century English. It had greater use of vocabulary. It could create word images better, and so on. But you'll find that that a lot of people would never, and this goes for academics as well as the populace as a whole. They basically view Shakespearean English as a kind of English without grammar, and therefore it is to be avoided. And this is something that comes home very personally. If you, for instance, talk to people up in the Appalachians where I'm from, you'll find that people in general have two attitudes about local English. One of them is that local English harks back to an earlier day. You will find some people who say that it harks back to pure Scotch-Irish English, and you'll find some people who say it harks back to pure Elizabethan English. Anyone who knows a little geography can see a contradiction there. Those are two parts of the old country many hundreds of miles away from each other and speaking different kinds of English. You'll find people thinking, therefore, that the old-time people spoke a better kind of English, more expressive, more colorful, and so on. And yet, they spoke a kind of English that we'd never want to teach our children in school. Absolutely not. The kind of English we want to teach our children in school is the kind of English with grammar, with rules, that is the kind of English that's going to be needed in the 20th century. In fact, I've heard innumerable people say, well, yes, something to the effect that old Grandfather Henry certainly knew how to use the English language, but he had no grammar. This is exactly the same point of view that people like John Simon take.
He's talking about eloquence and not standards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. John Simon is a drama critic, of course, and a well-known commentator on the English language in Esquire and elsewhere. Very flamboyant commentator, but he has a very definite appreciation for Shakespeare. But his sort of bottom line statement about Shakespeare is that Shakespeare had no grammar to guide his writing, and that he would be an even better playwright if he had if he had the OED, or if he had had Johnson's Dictionary, or if he had had one of these multi-volume grammars of English.
Well, I'm not sure about Simon, but several critics come to mind when you're talking about clarity and expressiveness, and I use the word eloquence. People like Edwin Newman and Richard Mitchell, for instance, say that what they're worried about is just mushiness in language, words that obfuscate, words that deliberately try to avoid meaning and try to avoid clarity mm-hmm. in communication, mm-hmm. and people picking them up and recognizing that. So it's not so much changing that's going on in the language that some of the critics are worried about, as it is fraudulent language in the use of evasiveness. For instance, in bureaucratic language, military language, the language of the schools of education. I am singling those out as examples, but I mean those are just several examples. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
Well, in the first place, the notion that there's been a change here and that somehow things are getting worse mm-hmm. is incredible. If you go back and look at late 19th century, the language of late 19th century political campaigns, the language of late 19th century military, well, their version of the military-industrial complex, I guess, the language of 19th century industrialists, the late 19th century American advertisements. I think you'll find that that what we have today is even at its worst is very often a masterpiece of clarity and precision and eloquence and beauty compared to what one finds at earlier stages of the American Republic. The notion that things are getting worse, I suppose to be slightly too optimistic, but my feeling is we're much better off today than we were 100 years ago with respect to exactly those issues. Now, this is not to say that they're not to some extent right, that there are not egregious examples of stupidity, of jargon, of nonsense, of deviousness in the use of language in all of those establishments, including the pop grammarians themselves, which you have which you've just enumerated. But the whole linguistic treatment of American Indians in the 19th century in the United States is an interesting case in point.
Connie?
I think these are not linguistic problems. The ones that the pop grammarians are addressing about obfuscation and that sort of, that's not a problem with the language. That's a problem with the users of the language. If it's a problem of honesty, it's a problem with the honesty of the user of the language, not of the honesty of the language itself.
But the language suffers, doesn't it? Is it, the language is whatever you want to call it.
The language doesn't have
a
life unto its own, separate from the people who use the language.
You say it does or does not.
It does not.
It does not. That's a very misleading metaphor, I think, to say that the language suffers somehow. The people who use it may suffer.
They undoubtedly suffer because they suffer from their own sloppy logic and dishonesty.
That somebody is going to hear that language, that a child eventually will pick that language up, a young person will pick it up and use it, thinking that simply having heard it, that's the way the language should be used.
You're talking about an educational problem now, and this is something that that anyone who teaches freshman composition in a major American university, I think, would agree is a problem. And again, I'd say it's probably always been a problem, and is perhaps less a problem today than it was 100 years ago.
Well, this means that words are such frail little. They're so delicate. I mean, they're so vulnerable that you can...
What do you think a word represents? Do you think a word represents a piece of truth that has a label onto it? I mean, words are conventions. They are an agreement between the speakers of the language, or among the speakers of the language.
They don't belong to anyone.
That a certain sound is going to have a range of meanings customarily associated with it for a period of time.
And somebody, for instance, like John Simon, wants to nail a meaning down. Wants to say, here is the way here's the way this word is going to be used, and we're not going to change it. Is that it?
Yes, it seems as if...
What Mike was talking about when he talked about control?
That's divination. That's not control.
Change is natural. We seem to have a feeling that change is the strange condition, but change is the natural condition. And we've got it backwards. We're acting as if the fixedness of the language should be the natural, God-given condition of language, and change is some terrible thing happening. Well, it's the other way around. The language is constantly changing, and if it is fixed for a period of time, it is not a human language. No human language has ever been seen to be fixed for a period of time.
And in a way, Wayne, even the title under which we're speaking is misleading, since state of the language implies
a
something that's standing still and is static.
You've been listening to the second segment in a series of discussions on the state of the English language, its history and evolution. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The speakers were Margretta de Grazia, Michael Montgomery, Connie Ebley, and Ronald Butters. Margretta de Grazia teaches English at Georgetown University. She's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where she's writing a book about Shakespeare and language. Michael Montgomery teaches linguistics at the University of South Carolina. Connie Ebley is a professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Ronald Butters teaches English and composition at Duke University. He serves as editor of American Speech, a journal of linguistics. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. Back to nature. That's a phrase that can take several different meanings. To Werner Danhauser, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of government at Cornell University, the words back to nature occasion the following reflections.
What's happened to sex in the last 15 years? Maybe nobody knows. Privacy still shrouds the subject. So sex remains to some extent inaccessible to our lust for data. People still do it, but the details are subject to the sanctioned lies of those who do it too much or too little. All our speculations fail to transcend speculation, for when it comes to sex, each of us speaks from a small corner of experience and a vast domain of brooding. Compounding my own ignorance is the fact that I've aged about 10 years during the past 15, a fate that may skew my views. Well, what has happened to sex in the last 15 years? Women's liberation, that is the main part of the answer. The question used to be, what does woman want? And when we asked that, we were not like Freud, expressing despair at our inability to understand women. We accepted them as wondrously strange and tried to please them, to win their approval. Today, the question more often than not has become, what does the women's liberation movement want? That's hard to say, but in one momentous respect, all feminists agree. The whole movement distrusts nature. That is why it puts all its eggs into the rickety basket called socialization and does its best to deny that one can socialize with the grain or against it. But one can blame a hostile environment only so long. Sooner or later, one begins to rail against the way things are. Never mind that nature may have graced women in very special ways. The resentment of nature is the key to the women's movement. It explains its alliance with the left, which cannot be due to the way women are treated in countries calling themselves Marxist. It explains the movement's grim mood, the absence in it of humor and of gratitude for the world we inhabit. It also explains why the women's movement may begin by promoting sexual equality, but forever bends in a direction of assaulting sexuality as such. It is as forthrightly sexual beings, after all, that we are most natural. When Eros possesses us, we do not care for differences of race, of nationality, of social station. We just want to do what comes naturally. The most outstanding paradox of the last 15 years is that a movement professing to be interested in liberation has everywhere produced a new sexual constraint. Fewer women now want to argue with men. Bristling is the mode. Fewer men want to be bold with women. All vestiges of courage are now considered to be a form of despicable machismo. Can this onslaught on nature succeed? I don't know, but signs abound to the effect that nature has been wounded, that in 1983 sex isn't what it was in 1967. I hope that nature proves as resilient as she is supposed to be. I do hope she prevails, defended by both men and women who find it natural to assist nature. I hope the day will return when we can once more celebrate sexuality as gloriously as did the writer of the biblical proverb. There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not, the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid.
Werner Danhauser teaches government at Cornell University. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he directs two of the center's seminars, one on citizenship and the second on commerce and culture. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations, interviews, and comments from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities.